I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Few instruments are more iconic of the past 100 years in music than the guitar. And for many musicians, it's more than just an instrument, it's an extension of themselves. Today, hear stories of some well-known musicians, some well-kept secrets, and their favorite six strings. Then, learn how economics is as much about everybody's mindset as it is about math. Yale economist Robert Shiller spotted the housing market bubble before it happened. And oh, he won the Nobel Prize for economics. We'll ask him why he thinks math psychology is key to accurately predicting the stock market. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. A lot of us are attached to something. Maybe we're collectors, or maybe we're just into one thing or another. For musicians, though, their instruments become almost extensions of themselves, and the attachment between player and guitar, for instance, can be profound. Chuck Holly has documented all this in a new book of stories and photographs, the book A Perfectly Good Guitar, Musicians on Their Favorite Instruments. Chuck Holly joins us now, and so good to have you. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
This all started with a conversation you had with a guy in a small band in Cedar Falls, Iowa.
That's right, about that. At the Boathouse. Yeah. The name of the band, they've long since broken up, was Puddin' Truck.
Why not?
Well, sure. And I watched them play one night, and at the end of the night, they were packing up, and I struck up a conversation with him, and I said, "You sounded great, but what happened to that Les Paul? It was all beat up, and there were scratches and scars and dings on it." And that's all I had to say. He eagerly shared these stories. He just opened up with all these stories, and each ding, each scar had a story associated with it. And I thought about that later, and I thought, I wonder if that would make a premise, a good premise for a book.
And
so I started approaching working musicians, and my intent was to interview working musicians who are respected within their circles. Mm-hmm. They may have some notoriety. They may not have much notoriety to the average guy in the street, but they are all serious players and serious songwriters.
You know, what comes through in this book, it seems to me, Chuck, is just the outright passion that a lot of players have for their guitars. I mean, they are linked, obviously, in some very important ways here.
Oh, sure. Yeah. They are, yeah. And they feel passionate mm-hmm. about their axes. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's who they are. And a lot of these places, a lot of these players have stayed true to their guitars for years and even decades, right?
Oh, sure.
They just go way back together.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I've heard about instruments they have for 40, 50 years. Yeah. I've heard about homemade instruments, which have a very strong tie to the player, too.
Yeah, I've seen Willie Nelson a few times, and you see him on stage, and that guitar looks like, I don't know what's holding that thing together.
Trigger.
It is.
Yeah.
It's called Trigger?
It has a name.
Yeah.
You bet. Named after Roy Rogers' horse, Trigger.
Yeah.
Sure.
You wonder what holds it together.
Well, the story of Trigger is very well documented, and the repairman luthier in Austin, Texas, Mark Erlewine, works on Trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And they give Trigger a lot of TLC.
Yeah. You know, some players refer to their guitars as mere tools.
Sure.
In what context?
Well, for example, one of the artists I interviewed in Nashville, Tommy Emmanuel, he said, really, this is just a pile of wood. And when he gets a new acoustic guitar, he immediately takes a screwdriver and start scraping away at the finish on the front side of the guitar. And the reason is because when he plays, he will also rub his hand against that abrasion for an acoustic effect while he plays. Now, most people would be horrified to see to have one scrape
a beautiful new instrument like that.
Exactly. Yeah. But not Tommy. It's very functional to him.
Did one brand of guitar emerge from, you know, all the players you spoke to, Chuck, as sort of the brand to have?
Oh, I'd say without question, the Fender Telecaster.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in here.
Yeah, there are a lot of Tele stories. And
what is that? For listeners who aren't familiar with it, describe that guitar.
What is a Telecaster? It is the first solid body electric guitar, which was designed and made by Leo Fender back in the early 1950s. And it is the design remains largely unchanged.
Wow.
since it was introduced, and it is a workhorse.
Mm-hmm. And people have been with it for years and years.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So even some of the premier brands to our listeners, and what makes them premier to begin with? What makes a Tele a Tele and a Gibson a Gibson?
Well, one artist I spoke with, Louis Perez of Los Lobos, said, in my mind, there are guitars and then there are Telecasters. It's almost like the Telecaster is
a thing,
a species all its own.
Yeah.
What makes a Tele or a Gibson, it's the workmanship, the attention to detail. It's a strange mix. It's like a gumbo. It's the wood. It's the choice of wood used. It's the stain used. It's the pickup used. It's the type of bridge used also has an effect.
Do you play guitar?
Oh, badly. Yeah,
badly.
But I do.
Yeah, but you do, so you know something about
it. Well, sure. I have a working knowledge of guitars, and I've been asked that a lot, particularly by the people I interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, well, yeah, I play, but I'm sure no expert.
Yeah.
And they say, well, if you're really not an expert, how can you do a book? And I said, well, I can ask questions.
Yeah.
I can pose a question. I can shut up and listen to the answer.
And that's what you did in this book, right? Because the book is a compilation of sort of oral histories as told by the players, and you stay out of it.
Well, I do. I look at it as each chapter is a very tiny slice of musical history.
Mm-hmm. As told by the players themselves.
As told by the players themselves. The stories are in their words. And I thought it was very important to keep the story in their words. As a point of reference, I'm a big fan of Studs Terkel. And mm-hmm. I don't think any more has to be said.
As am I. Yeah.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with Chuck Holly from Maryville, right?
Maryville. Absolutely.
About his new book, A Perfectly Good Guitar, Musicians on Their Favorite Instruments. It's an oral history from a whole host of musicians about their love for their particular guitars. Let's go to one of the stories that you tell in this book that I just loved. Sonny Landreth tells a story about a 65 Strat that he left behind at a bar one night, but one that later came back to him in a very roundabout way. Tell us that story.
Well, the 65 Strat Sonny told me about is actually owned by his bass player, Dave Ranson.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes back to 1972. They were playing a gig north of Lafayette.
And it was ugly.
It was a rough area.
Yeah.
He said there were clubs in the area with gambling, strippers, that sort of thing, the works. And he said this place wasn't quite, it didn't go that far down that road, but he said it was a pretty rough place.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the crowd hated us. And he said, I think at one point they wanted to beat us up. And at the end of the night, they went to the club owner, who begrudgingly paid them all of $100. And they got the money and they just wanted to get out of there. And a few days later, his bass player, Dave, called him up and he says, hey, I want to come by and get that Strat. And Sonny said, what do you mean? Don't you have it? And Dave said, no, I don't have it. Don't you have it?
Huh.
Turns out
They left it behind.
They left it at the club, and so they went back the next day. And of course, oh no, there's no guitar here. No, yeah. we didn't see no guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had resigned themselves to the fact that they wouldn't see that again.
And Sonny felt awful about it because he felt responsible.
Oh yeah, he did. Well, years later, fast forward to 1982, they were. Sonny was playing in a band called the Bayou Rhythms, and they were backing up Zachary Richard one day when they had heard through the grapevine that this club owner had a Strat for sale. Sonny looks at Dave. Dave looks at Sonny. They made eye contact, and they thought,
It can't be.
This
is a different band, a different decade, same club. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. So they go back to the club. And in the ensuing years, this club owner, he was not exactly a pillar of the community, if you know what I mean. He had done some time, and he was out of prison. And they ask him about the guitar, and he says, "Oh yeah, I have it. It's my son's, and it's a beauty. But he wants to sell it." And he pulls it out, and Sonny says, "Well, you're right. This is a beautiful guitar. The only problem is
it's my guitar.
Exactly. We left it here 9 years ago, and we came back, and you said you didn't have it." Mm-hmm. And he immediately started backpedaling and
lowering the price.
Fabricated stories about how he really acquired the car. Yeah. And he said, "Well, Sonny said, well, let's go. We're going to go see what the police have to say about this." Mm-hmm. And he said, as we walked closer and closer to the door, the price of the guitar dropped
precipitously.
Yes. Long story short, they make a police report. One of the policemen drives by the club, and when he pulls up, the club owner was waiting for him in the parking lot with
the guitar,
just handed it over to him.
Yeah, there you go. That's a great story.
Happy ending to that one.
Somebody else in this book, one of my favorites, Roseanne Cash, who has been here at the Folly Theater any number of times,
sure,
told this great story about getting a phone call from the Martin guitar rep who told her they were going to make a signature Roseanne Cash guitar. How big a moment was that for Roseanne Cash?
Well, she put this in perspective, and she said...
I'm not a great guitar player. Yeah.
Right.
Is what she said.
Yeah. And she said, Martin has been connected with her family forever. And years before, when Martin Guitars called her father, Johnny Cash, and they told him they wanted to make a Johnny Cash signature guitar. When Johnny picked up the phone and they said who they were, he didn't even say hello. He said, "I've been waiting for this call my whole life."
Because they were going to make a signature Johnny Cash guitar.
Exactly.
And that was a sign of a certain stature in the industry.
Exactly. Yeah. And she said, "I knew exactly what my dad was saying, because it was, as a guitar player, I just felt like it was a great honor, and it gave me a feeling of legitimacy over my entire body of work in my career."
She really labored over what she wanted in her signature guitar, and then finally, how she described how overwhelmed she was when she played her signature guitar for the first time. Describe that moment for us.
Well, she really didn't have. As she told me, she's not a great guitar player. Her husband, John Leventhal,
who's also in the book,
mm-hmm. very well-known producer. She said, "I had ideas of what I wanted it to look like, what I wanted it to sound like, but I really didn't have the vocabulary to express this to Martin." Well, her husband did, and she said, I had a picture in my mind of what I wanted this guitar to look like. She said years before I had seen an old tape of Loretta Lynn playing a white electric guitar back in the late 50s or early 60s. She said, "I just thought that was so cool."
Yeah.
"I wanted a white guitar."
A white guitar.
John Leventhal said, "No, it can't be white. It can't be white." But instead, they chose a very light-colored Adirondack spruce. She said, "I wanted it to be very girly in appearance with lots of mother-of-pearl on the neck." Mm-hmm. And John said, you don't want that. It will wear on you.
Yeah.
You want a very classic look. And she said, when we finally conveyed what we wanted it to look like and sound like, I waited and I waited and I waited, and it finally arrived, and I pulled it out of the box and I played it, and I just cried. It was beautiful.
Mm. Let's listen to what that guitar sounds like. This is Roseanne Cash, Girl from the North Country. I was really struck, Chuck, a lot of these players let you into their homes, and I think Roseanne was one of them. Did that surprise you?
It did. It did, and it didn't. For example, Roseanne and John live in New York City,
mm-hmm.
And I don't.
Yeah.
I had no place to photograph her, and so they very graciously invited me into their home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Nice thing to do.
It was very nice, and it's very trusting,
mm-hmm.
and I don't take that for granted.
Right.
I didn't take it for granted with any of these artists who shared their stories with me, and they trusted me to tell their stories accurately.
You know, I was struck, as you mentioned, you took the photographs for this book. So many of them are just spectacular. What were you looking for in these photographs?
Well, whenever possible, I wanted to create a photograph which reflected in some way on their story. If that wasn't possible, then I wanted to take a very nice, very elegant, very clean-looking environmental portrait. And by clean, I mean in terms of design.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Lawrence Juber had a very different kind of story about his guitar. He played in Wings, the Paul McCartney band from back in 1980, when something went down that made worldwide headlines in Japan. What happened there with Lawrence Juber?
Well, your students your listeners who are students of rock and roll history will remember that when the band Wings were beginning their the Japanese leg of the tour,
right?
They Paul McCartney got busted for pot.
Mm-hmm.
And
in the airport in Tokyo,
in customs. Yeah, in customs in Japan. But what led up to that was they were all in London. Half the band flew east to Japan. Lawrence decided to fly west through New York City,
mm-hmm.
and he said by coincidence the McCartneys flew west too. He said, we stopped over in New York City for the weekend, and I stopped, I went to the Mecca of guitar stores back then in New York City on 48th Street.
Mm-hmm.
It's known as Music Row. And he said, I found this beautiful 1957 Les Paul Gold Top. And he said it was reasonably priced, so he purchased it. And he said, I continued on. I flew on the same flight with the McCartneys. And when we arrived in Japan, we were in customs. I was standing right next to Paul. And they opened up a suitcase, and they found this small bag of pot.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all hell just broke loose.
What happened next?
Well, he said Paul was immediately escorted to another room. He said, I was escorted to a room. And I had my Les Paul with me in the original case. And he said a custom agent was walking towards him with a screwdriver. And he wanted to dismantle this 57 Les Paul. Lawrence was the victim of of guilt by association.
Mm-hmm.
And he said there are only three things you can take apart on a Les Paul, and there are two small panels on the back of the guitar to get to the electronics and that sort of thing. And he says, I took the screwdriver, and I took the panels off just to prove that there was nothing in there. And he said this caused such an uproar because Paul had been denied a work permit in Japan in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But they made a special dispensation for this tour, and we had all been advised to make sure our pockets were vacuumed clean of anything illegal.
And it didn't work out.
Well, not so well. He said Paul spent 10 days in jail, and as a result, the rest of the tour was canceled, including the North American leg.
Well, lots of other great guitarists in this book. J.D. Souther, Bill Frisell, Dave Alvin, who's played at Knuckleheads here in town, Lisa Morales, Joanna Connor, and others as well. The book, A Perfectly Good Guitar, Musicians on Their Favorite Instruments. Chuck Holly is the author and photographer for this book. Thanks so much for sharing some good stories.
Steve,
I sure appreciate
thank you
it.
So much. It's been a blast.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk to Nobel winner Dr. Schiller about the economy. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the smart money expert shared end-of-the-year financial advice and pondered possible impacts of the Trump tax plan. You can find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll look back at the history of Kansas City through the architecture that's all around us. Also, pediatrician Natasha Burgert is in to discuss appropriate and effective use of kids' car seats. That's tomorrow on our show. Well, Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller has been at the forefront of the idea that investing in the stock market is all about mass psychology and human emotion, and not necessarily that these dense laws of economics. The key, he says, is not necessarily picking the best companies, but picking stocks of companies that other people will want to buy. These days, he's describing the market as obese, but lacking the psychological preconditions for a spiraling downturn. Professor Shiller will be in town next week to accept the 2017 Truman Medal for Economic Policy. He's consistently ranked among the world's 100 most influential economists, and he's the author of the bestseller Irrational Exuberance. Dr. Shiller, what a pleasure to have you. Welcome.
My pleasure, too.
So the market is overweight, you say. Stock prices are crazy high, and yet you're reluctant to suggest that a big downturn is looming tomorrow, and I'm wondering why.
It could happen tomorrow, but I'd be very surprised. Actually, downturns don't happen in one day. The news media focuses on big one-day events, but they tend to chip away at themselves. And so I think that's possible. But it doesn't feel like 1929 or 2000 or 2007. Now, the narratives are different, so I don't know. It may change quickly, but so far, I just don't see the intense worry that we saw in other episodes that led to selling.
Just how overweight is the market right now?
Well, I have my own measure of overweight called CAPE, Cyclically Adjusted Price Earnings Ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And by that ratio, it's price divided by 10-year average earnings. That ratio now is at 31. And there's only been two times when it was higher. In 1929, you remember that year?
Yeah.
There was this, the market lost 80% of its value in the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And the other time was in the year 2000. And after that, it lost nearly half its value in a year or two.
Hmm. You're having a hard time explaining our optimistic view of the markets right now. I'm wondering, how much does President Trump have to do with all this?
Well, we had seen already before Trump was elected, under Obama, we'd seen quite a bull market. I don't think it's just Trump. But I think that, and it's hard to explain. I think we're trying to talk about psychology.
Mm-hmm.
There were many investors, not all of them in the U.S., you know, who found Trump refreshing. the man who speaks his mind. We know he does that.
Mm-hmm.
And who's also very capitalist. So it's got to be good for the stock market.
Well, clearly his confidence and his buoyancy is, you know, it seems to be having an effect here because, as you point out, the prices right now are crazy.
Well, I think so, though not everyone. There are these efficient markets theorists who claim that the price is always right because, as they put it, the stock market is like the outcome of a vote of all the people who will put their money where their mouth is. And the outcome of that vote is better than anybody's forecast. That's a popular theory. I don't ascribe to it.
Can I ask, how invested in the market are you right now?
Well, I actually am. Most of my equity investments are abroad. You don't have to stay in the United States. And my U.S. investments are in sectors that are not the whole market, but in sectors that don't look as pricey.
Mm-hmm. Why are you in the international market?
Because they're cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going so far as to invest in Russia. Russia is the cheapest stock market in the world. The CAPE ratio for Russia is about 6. I mean, it's just off the charts. Now, why aren't people rushing to buy Russia? They worry about the situation there, and they worry about corruption. So who knows whether they're right or not?
Yeah.
I can't prove any of these things, but you know, you get a sense that something is over or underpriced.
Nobel Prize-winning economist Robert Shiller is my guest. You compare studying the economy to studying mass psychology. Explain that to us, because most people don't look at it that way.
Yeah, I know. The problem. The problem starts in our universities, where we've divided them up into departments. That happened sometime at the late 19th century. And you move them off into separate buildings, so the economists don't talk to the psychologists anymore. Hmm. And they start to develop their own culture. We're not psychologists, so they think. But actually, I think that if you look at all the major events in history, they have psychological underpinnings. We don't just have a depression. People are depressed, or at least a lot of them are in those times. So it affects their thinking.
And the connection between the economy and psychology is what then? Go a step further for me.
Well, I'm emphasizing now narratives, that there's a certain story of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that story colors all it can pervade everyone's thinking. So let's go back to the election of Donald Trump. Doesn't it strike you that it's like everybody was talking about this? They were split. Half of them liked him and half of them didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But they all wanted to talk. They all wanted to hear his latest antics. I would call them antics, his tweets.
Mm-hmm.
He was amusing, just fun to watch. Whether you liked him or not, he was an entertainer. And there was always something to say about him. That kind of thing happens repeatedly in history, where everyone is focused on one thing. In the Great Depression, they were all focused on the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, in a recent piece in the Times, you examined newspaper headlines. What were you looking for there, and what did you find out?
Well, I'm trying to understand what people were talking about at various times in history. And it may seem puzzling to us afterwards. So, for example, not many people even remember the Depression of the 1890s. You remember that one?
Not really.
Well, we have kind of childrenized memories of it. During the election of 1900, which when the Depression was still there, a man named L. Frank Baum wrote a book called The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to influence the election, apparently. Remember that? It takes place in Kansas, by the way.
Oh, we all remember it out here, Dr. Shiller. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, everybody in the whole world. I was just talking at an international conference, and I asked, who doesn't remember The Wizard of Oz? And there were like 5 hands out of 200 went up. And the guy, I said, where are you from? He said, France. I said, okay, maybe it hasn't been a day. But everybody else knew. But we remember a distorted story of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening then? You know, if you open up a history book it will tell you that there was a big controversy over bimetallism, whether we should go on the gold and silver standard. Now, why in the world would people get into that? That sounds awfully technical. But, you know, everyone was talking about it. And in Kansas, they were silverites. It was geographical. And in New York, they were gold bugs. And they were arguing. And it got personal. They were getting angry. The whole nation seemed to be falling apart over this technical economic issue. You have to be there to appreciate it.
But your point is you look at newspaper headlines to get a sense of the tenor of the times, and that begins to suggest how the market is responding and why it's responding the way it is.
Right. So, the newspapers tell stories. I mean, they're I'm not saying they're not factual, but they embellish stories that seem interesting. Now, so during the 2007 crisis, they were telling stories about the Great Depression, and they created a big depression scare, and that may have helped President Bush and Obama put through stimulative policies, but it didn't help confidence. So people were pulling back on their spending.
Robert Shiller,
depression worse.
Yeah, Robert Shiller will accept the 2017 Truman Medal for Economic Policy at 6:30 Monday evening at the Truman Forum at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. The event is free and open to the public, but RSVPs are requested at TrumanLibraryInstitute.org/medal. I'll put that address out and again in just a little bit. If you have a question for Dr. Shiller, he's one of the world's most influential economists. This would be a great time to call. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR.org. You know, I'm wondering, you're married to a psychologist, Dr. Shiller. Does that skew your thinking on all this at all?
Yeah. I think in a healthy marriage, you do get skewed thinking with your spouse. But, she writes books in psychology. Her latest is on attachment, mothers and children's attachment. Kind of related to what I do.
Yeah. Well, there's a theory from back in the 1930s that you wrote about that compares the stock market to a quirky beauty contest of all things. What's the connection there?
Yeah, okay, so newspapers, this is before the Miss America pageant. It's a different kind of beauty contest. The newspaper would have a full page of 100 photographs of pretty faces, and then you were to pick the six prettiest and write down the number or the name and then send it into the newspaper. And you would win. The girls weren't competing. You were competing. You would win if your six came closest to the top six of all entries. See, now, this is a funny puzzle because you shouldn't pick the girls that you think are prettiest. You should pick those that you think other people would think are prettiest. But that's not right either because everyone else is doing that. So you want to pick the faces that you think that other people think that other people think are the prettiest. So this goes so John Maynard Keynes, a famous economist in the 1930s, said, you know, the stock market is like that. You don't pick the best stocks. You want to sell it to someone else. So you're trying to pick the stock that somebody else will think is great soon.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty good. Let's go to some phone calls here for Dr. Robert Shiller. Let's go to Bill from Overland Park. Bill, good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment and then a question.
Yeah.
Dr. Shiller and I went to high school together, actually. And I wanted to ask him about the education of economics in high school.
Where did you go to high school with him, Bill?
Southfield, Michigan.
Wow, great. Yeah.
I didn't take economics in high school. I probably didn't know what it was, but I was in the accelerated math program, as well as Dr. Shiller. Had great effect on me. We had great teachers. Roger Susi and Kenneth Hall.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Susi. Yes, I remember him. He was great.
Terrific. But I did take economics in college in Michigan, where you went also, the year with Daniel Suits. And I realized...
We have a lot in common, yeah.
I realized just how important this education was, and I felt it was as important as taking American history and American government in high school. And I would like your comments on whether we're neglecting teaching secondary students economics.
What about the teaching of economics, Dr. Schiller?
Well, I didn't take an econ course in high school, but Mr. Soucy got me going on math research. That was a turning point for me.
Wow.
He encouraged me to write. I started proving theorems, and he would respond. So I had a good experience in high school. It would have been good if I had learned economics then, but that wasn't until college.
Yeah. Why did you take econ in high school?
Why didn't I take econ in high school? I don't know. I don't remember what was offered, but I wasn't into it. That came to me later in college.
Go ahead, Bill.
I don't think I understood what economics was, but I think it's so important that I think it would benefit our high school students to take some economics just as much as American government and American history.
Well, I think it's important. I've spent my life with it.
All right. Bill, thanks for the call. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. How concerned are you about the overpriced stock market? At least that's the view of some folks. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Brian from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a question for Dr. Schiller, and it was focused on trying to understand how the CAPE ratio he was discussing earlier and some of the behavioral tendencies of investors, how that can be extended to valuation of our startups in Silicon Valley and other places and kind of the prevalence of unicorns these days.
Okay, startups, Dr. Schiller.
Good question, because we're taking a price earnings ratio with 10-year average earnings in the denominator, and we just don't have that for startups.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see a way out, but we just launched in Toronto last week. I've been working with Barclays Bank, a new index looks not at startups, just the opposite. It looks at established firms. We call them old standbys, for which there is a long earnings history record. That product is available. I don't know how to do it for startups. You know, startups are a whole puzzling territory to me. I'm not expert on how do you know whether there's so many startups fail? How do you know which ones won't? And I don't have an answer.
Is there a way ever to get an answer for something like that?
Well, I'm sure careful study and, I'd like to meet or watch the management. Are they impressive? Do they know what they're doing?
Right.
And you have to also consider whether they have something that can't be competed away or not. What is it? I mean, so for example, Bitcoin, you know that one.
Yes.
It's been a phenomenal success. But why? Now there's hundreds of cryptocurrency companies. And why was that one a success? You know, it's not just judging the management. It's judging the story or the Bitcoin has a great story. They were kind of a first mover, and they've really taken off. But how can you predict that the next time? That's tough. It's a game that,
Bitcoin being a form of digital currency, are there any other potential market bubbles out there right now?
Well, you know, since the whole stock market in the U.S. is in a bubble, and I'm not panicking about it. I think, I still have money, although I tend to favor money in it. I just tend to favor picking lower-priced sectors and not being so but even technology looks like an interesting investment in the U.S. The U.S. is a leader in technology. And I suspect they will stay that way.
For our listeners who might be unfamiliar with the concept, what is a bubble exactly?
Good question. It's not well defined. When I won the Nobel Prize with Gene Fama, we had a big argument in front of the audience about what is a bubble. and we couldn't agree on it. For some people, a bubble is a sudden, swift run-up in prices that is sure to burst. It can't keep going up. It gets so high that only the most enthusiastic investors are there, and there's nobody who will buy it from them at a higher price, so it collapses. For me, a bubble is something more psychological. It's just a state of time when there's extraordinary public attention and enthusiasm for an investment. And it's bringing in people who aren't thinking as carefully. And it won't last forever, but you can't predict when it's going to burst. Even if it bursts, it might pick up again. Bitcoin burst. In 2013, the stock market was soaring, and then it collapsed. But it wasn't done. It started again last year or this year.
But still, you've received a lot of recognition for spotting the internet bubble back in the late 90s and the housing bubble before the 2008 financial crisis. What went into figuring all that out, Doctor?
Well, a lot of things, partly my CAPE ratio that I've been advertising, but it was also my willingness to look at psychology, look at what people are saying, listening to their narratives, and listening for signs of excess. Just as in 1929 or other episodes, it's like everybody was talking about the stock market or the housing market. You know, it's obvious that people were really excited. That's a bad sign for me in the long run. In the short run, it might cause it to be a great investment. But economists don't like to judge things that way. They think it's unprofessional. They want to talk about what the Federal Reserve Bank has just, what they've just done, as if it's all there. Well, part of it is there. We have to trust those people, but it's not all there.
Slightly different topic. You said that automation and artificial intelligence are the trends that most concern you now about the economy's prospects going forward. Explain that to us.
Yeah, well, we're going through a rapid advance in computer technology. Now you can talk to them, and you can joke with them. They know. They anticipate your needs. They'll interrupt you when you're driving your car to tell you that there's bad traffic ahead, and they'll tell you a route to escape it. They're doing so many things. Then you wonder, what is it going to be doing in 30 years when your children are, you know, looking for jobs? Will they have a job?
That's your big concern about the young people coming up today. What will happen to them?
Yeah. And parents are concerned. That's part of the reason why the stock market and the housing market are high, because parents are buying these things for their children. They think their human capital, their abilities, their labor income is not guaranteed. They might not get a job. So they want something.
You also have concerns for the large inequality gap that young folks will face going into a working economy. What's happening on that front?
Well, inequality was bad in the 1920s and 30s, and it got better in the 50s and 60s. And then it started to get worse again. And it's especially concentrated in the very top, the top 1% or the top 0.1%. This is largely due, I think, to computers already, because they can replace routine jobs. So I think this has a good chance of getting worse. I'm not the only one, obviously. Everyone, this is the talk of our time. I'm just concurring with. There's two sides to this. There are people who said people have been worrying about machines replacing jobs for 200 years, and it hasn't caused disastrous inequality yet. But my thought is, give it time. And it might. It might really.
Well, what do you make of the vast wealth gap between the rich and the poor in this country, and how detrimental is that, or is it detrimental, for a capitalistic society?
Well, the American dream is an idea that people who try hard and work hard can get ahead, and there will be opportunities in a free society. And let's hope that's true. We don't really know where all this is going. But I'm just worried that there's too many, you know, it's not just computer science, it's also neuroscience. They're understanding better how the human brain works, and they can replicate it. They can make a machine now that that is friendly, and you might prefer machines to people. That's a scary thought. There's this in Japan. There's a service that a young woman can get that will give her an electronic boyfriend. And the boyfriend will be really reliable and sweet and send her messages, love messages every day.
There you go. There you go.
But he's not real.
But is this wealth gap, is it, does it threaten the economy just on its face?
Well, well, there is a talk that low-income people might not spend as much. If they're not really low-income, if they feel their income is threatened, they might not spend. I'm sorry. High-income people might not spend because they what can you do with all this wealth?
Mm-hmm.
Low-income don't have enough income to spend, so there could be an inadequate aggregate demand, and it could put us in a depression. There's some thought, worry, that that might be happening with the well, the U.S. economy is at full employment. It's only at full employment because of very low interest rates.
Mm-hmm. Economist Robert Shiller is my guest. We're running out of time here, Doctor, but I'm wondering, how did winning the Nobel Prize change your life?
The biggest thing is it made me busy. There's too many events that want a Nobel Prize winner. I don't think they care which Nobel Prize winner, but I've been very busy ever since.
Was it a positive change?
It's also disorienting because I think I can't possibly achieve a higher level of accolade. Mm-hmm. What should I do?
Yeah.
Maybe I should be nice to my students. That's a thought.
Well, do you feel like everything you write is measured up against this Nobel Prize standard and you can't have a bad day?
Right. Well, what really strikes me is people will ask me very difficult questions and think I should know the answer.
And sometimes you don't, right? Yeah.
Very often I don't.
Dr. Robert Shiller will accept the 2017 Truman Medal for Economic Policy at 6:30 Monday evening at the Truman Forum at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. The event is free. RSVPs are encouraged at trumanlibraryinstitute.org/medal. Dr. Shiller, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for taking some time.
My pleasure, too.
You bet. Thank you. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, the return of a guidebook featuring hundreds of historic Kansas City sites. And we get car seat safety tips from Dr. Natasha Burgert. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.